over a dozen tests while being analysed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook. Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation. Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, well, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but that's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, that the shakeup that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example, wheat and rice. I mean, look at all this vertical space that will be wasted if you were to plant wheat in here. So, but that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit. And also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you, especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report.
Now for our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the food and agriculture industries and some of its related trades. Each year, millions of tons of food go to waste. That's awful. Now a United Nations report shows that Iranians have the lowest food waste per capita in the West Asian region. The report was put together by the Food Waste Index from the UN's Environment Programme. It shows that regardless of income, every Iranian throws away an average of 70 kilograms of food per year. This is below the global average set at nearly 80 kilograms. Food is mainly wasted in three areas: homes, food services, and retail. Household food waste accounted for the highest at 60% of this total. The agriculture sector is shifting towards technology to realize a new generation of agriculture in the country. Iranian knowledge-based companies have developed dozens of technological products in this field. The Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology says some 120 technologies have already been produced by 30 knowledge-based companies. These items are now being integrated into the industry. The products cover everything from cultivation to harvest and sales of crops and play an essential role in the productivity and sustainability of crops. Agriculture is one of the fields in which nanotechnology has been able to develop. Over 50 widely used nano products have been launched in this sector this year alone. The potential of nanotechnology in agriculture is high. Over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in the country are actively manufacturing a wide range of domestically needed products. Roughly 260 companies of this total are active in agriculture, biotechnology, and the food industry. Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with the second episode of the new series, Food Tourism. In the first episode, we talked about food tourism in general and said that Iran is one of the richest countries in the number of foods and drinks. Today, we are going to talk more about the Iranian foods and cuisine and make you familiar with a few Iranian foods. Hope you'll enjoy it. Food culture is a set of habits and customs originated in the culture of every nation and ethnicity. Alongside folklore, myths, music, arts, scripts, clothes, and habits, Food is an index of history and culture of that particular nation and ethnicity. Iran has a broad variety of subcultures, and this makes it colorful in every aspect of culture. For sure, climate variety has been effective in this regard. Thus, the taste of the northern people differs that of the south, and that is true for the people of the west and the east of the country. For instance, the cities near the sea are more familiar with seafood, while those busy in animal husbandry more like the dishes made from livestock and vegetables. As it was said earlier, there are over 2,600 foods, desserts, and drinks in Iran. This has made Iran one of the richest nations in the field of foods and drinks. It was also said that Iran's culinary method is the third famous method after the Chinese and Roman ones. Perhaps the current modern lifestyle has dragged people towards fast foods. But Iranians still prefer the traditional way of making cooking dishes, which is based on patience and take time to prepare. In other words, Iranians wait for rice to become steamed and the stew to fully cook. The Iranian culinary art is very fine and requires full attention, just like the Iranian carpet. This genuine art has grown among rural and civic people during the past centuries. A brief look at the Iranian tablecloth makes it clear that food is very valuable among Iranians. Speaking of the Iranian food and cuisine is indeed speaking of food variety and a set of customs, traditions, and beliefs which have bequeathed to us from generation to generation. Among these customs and beliefs, mention can be made of sitting together around a tablecloth, respecting the elderly in starting to eat, and paying attention to the foods being halal or haram. It is highly recommended in Islam to eat food in congregation. This will attract the divine blessing. Another Iranian tradition is hospitality, which is very evident in spreading the tablecloth and serving. The Iranian tablecloth takes special colors in various times of feasts. For example, on the national feast of Nowruz or New Year feast, rice is made with vegetables and served with fish. But on Yalda night, which is the longest night of the year, pomegranate, various nuts, and watermelon are the ingredients of the tablecloth. Furthermore, for religious ceremonies of the morning month of Muharram and the blessed month of Ramadan, special foods are prepared as votives, which can be seen less frequently during the year. These include different kinds of halim, broth, dates, halva, pastries like zulbia and bamiye. Dear listeners, Iran's traditional culinary system is based on principles which mainly focus health of foods. In other words, it is very important to see which foods should be eaten together to have the least negative effect on the health system. In view of this, dressings enjoy an important status in the Iranian cuisine and tablecloth. Thus, some dressings make one's temperament cold while others make it warm. As it has always been mentioned in Islam, it is very important for a food to be halal or religiously permitted. Therefore, some foods like pork and some drinks like alcohol have no place among Iranians, as they are Muslims. Today, scientific research has made it clear that the foods and drinks that are considered as haram or religiously forbidden in Islam are harmful for the body and spirit. When a tourist travels to a country, foods are among the first things which draw his or her attention. This has caused food tourism to find its way among nations and prove itself as a means of gaining revenues and promotion of cultural, historical, and religious aspects.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
There is no end in sight to the Israeli atrocities in the region. In a latest development, the regime carried out yet another airstrike near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Several people were killed and over a dozen injured. The attack heavily damaged nearby residential buildings. That after missiles hit the densely populated Kafar Susa neighborhood in central Damascus, where a security complex was located. One soldier was also said to have been killed as a result. The Syrian military said the air defense confronted what it called hostile targets in the sky around Damascus. Rights groups said the latest Israeli strike was the deadliest in the Syrian capital since last month, when another missile attack targeting Damascus International Airport left four people dead. The latest attack, like usual, drew strong condemnation from Damascus. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called the strike a crime against humanity. Iran and Russia separately condemned the attack. Iran's Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani slammed the West's, quote, shameful silence over repeated violations of Syria's sovereignty. Kanani called on the UN Security Council to react to the latest attack by Israel. Russia also called the assault a flagrant violation of international law. Moscow warned of what it called dire consequences for the region. The Israeli assault came days after over 50 people were killed in an ambush carried out by Daesh terror group in Syria's central desert province of Homs. Syrian media said the bodies of all victims taken to a state hospital had gunshot wounds to the head. Recent attacks carried out by the Israeli regime and the Daesh terror group come at a time when Syria is grappling with one of the deadliest earthquakes of all time in the history of the country. So far, nearly 6,000 people have died in Syria's recent earthquake. As the Syrian Foreign Ministry put it, at a time when Syria was trying to heal its wounds, bury its martyrs, and receive condolences, sympathy, and international humanitarian support in facing the devastating earthquake, the Israeli entity launched an air aggression targeting the civilian-populated residential neighborhoods in Damascus. Faisal Mehdad called on the United Nations Secretariat and UN Security Council to condemn the regime's aggression and hold it accountable for its crimes. Syria has been repeatedly complaining to the UN over Israeli repeated assaults, urging the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv's crimes, but those calls have all fallen on deaf ears. The international community has failed to take a single action in at least condemning such attacks. That comes to the spotlight, especially at a time when the United States maintains its occupation of Syria's eastern oil-rich provinces to steal the country's reserves. There are reports that the Americans load tankers and trucks with oil and wheat and send them over the border to Iraq. The U.S. occupation of oil-rich Syria, the Daesh terror attacks there, and the repeated Israeli missile strikes against the Arab country all take one to the conclusion that Washington and its allies still haven't given up in trying to destroy Syria. Not only one cannot expect any condemnation from Western countries with regards to the matters, there seems to be no international community who would want to do anything. After all, their interests lie in not taking any action. All in all, what seems to be crystal clear is the fact that Syria is still being punished for stopping the plans of those who wanted to create a new Middle East. That makes it even more auspicious when countries which were once hopeful of establishing a new government in Damascus are now normalizing relations with Syria.
Protesters have returned to major cities across Europe to voice their anger at the rising cost of living across the continent. In Spain, people held a massive rally in Madrid against what they call the regional government's dismantling of the public health care system. Officials say 250,000 people turned out, but organizers put the number as high as a million. That is the largest such demonstration in recent months. Protesters accuse the regional government of prioritizing private health. They say the public health service is suffering from staff and equipment shortages because of the government's policies. Some primary care doctors and healthcare workers have also been holding regular strikes over better working conditions and pay.
The condition of the public health system is deteriorating. The number of doctors have been decreasing with medical conditions getting worse. Many medical centers have been closed.
The region's right-wing leader has repeatedly claimed that the protesters are motivated by political interests. And in the Portuguese city of Lisbon, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis. It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. Officials say negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and express hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing decades-high inflation and is grappling with the cost of living crisis.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
Protests in Spain and Portugal come as passengers across Germany have witnessed widespread travel chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on a strike over a pay dispute. Verdi Trade Union called for the industrial action after it said collective bargaining efforts to settle wage disputes with the government failed. Since last year, European airlines have been facing labor strife amid staff shortages and soaring inflation, which have prompted employees to demand higher wages. German officials say despite a recent improvement, the economy is expected to suffer another mild decline in early 2023, as energy prices for households are still increasing. German consumer prices, harmonized to compare with other European Union countries, peaked at 11.6% in October, driven by the surge in energy prices and rising input costs. In the UK, more than 70% of UK households fear that they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first part of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year.
Nobody actually wants to be on strike. We want to do our jobs. We want to look after the students here. This is what our passion is. But we've been driven into a situation where we can't even pay our bills now. So basically, we've been forced to do this. Nobody works in education to be rich, but we'd like to have a decent standard of life. And I think we're losing a lot of staff as well. A lot of people are leaving because of the pay.
Meanwhile, in France, police clashed with people protesting the government's pension reform bill. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the rally, which was held in a number of other cities across France, seeking to keep up pressure on the government over the reform plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Emmanuel Macron says the reform is vital to ensuring the viability of the pension system.
We would like the age of retirement to remain the same. 62 is already enough for working people like us. We work in kindergarten in the way, and we don't see ourselves working with children at 64. It's already quite hard currently, and going farther isn't possible.
This is a democracy, and people only have a month to debate the pension reform. The government has kept its project hidden for months, despite the fact that it was ready, and they only yield on details when people take to the streets. Well, we will keep going.
The economic crises have been compounded by the protracted war in Ukraine. The war has pushed up prices, including the price of commodities like energy products. Furthermore, European nations have pledged billions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine, and that has sapped the capacities of European major economies to spend money on social welfare programs.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi visited China for an official three-day state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. The Iranian President arrived in Beijing earlier on Tuesday as the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation on an official invitation by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. Speaking to reporters before leaving Tehran for Beijing, Raisi said that Iran and China have similar views on fighting unilateralism at the international level. During the trip, the two countries sought to operationalize the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement, which was finalized in March 2021 in a bid to strengthen their long-standing economic and political alliance. The $400 billion deal will pave the way for Iran's joining the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Xi and Raisi attended the signing of 20 cooperation agreements, adding to a 25-year partnership agreement to cooperate in developing oil, industry, and other fields. The two sides signed a number of bilateral cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, tourism, environmental protection, health, disaster relief, culture, and sports. The Chinese leader said Beijing opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs and undermining Iran's security and stability. And President Ebrahim Raisi said that Iran and China are friends in hard times, stressing that further strengthening of relations between the two countries will contribute to the security of the region and the world. The visit comes amid rapid geopolitical shifts in the wake of protracted Ukraine war and the end of the unipolar world order led by the U.S. and its Western allies. China is now among Iran's top trading partners. Since 2022, the 10-month figure of trade between the two nations stands at $25.3 billion. That figure has surpassed the volume of trade between Iran and its other neighboring countries, like the UAE, Turkey, and Iraq. Since March of last year, Iran imported $12.7 billion worth of goods from China, and its exports to Beijing stood at $12.8 billion. President Raisi took office back in 2021, and since then he has tried to readjust Iran's foreign policy with a focus on eastern countries, which has come to be known as the Look to the East policy. It aims to forge alliances with non-Western countries, especially China and Russia. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. The bloc is a counterweight against U.S.-led security and economic blocs and could significantly reduce the hegemony of the U.S. in Asia. SCO member countries account for more than 40% of the world's population and contribute about 30% of the global gross domestic product, GDP. It's widely believed that Iran's close partnerships with countries like China will significantly erode Western hegemony and pave the way for a new world order.
Foreign ministers from France, Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom have followed the United States in denouncing the planned expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the ministers said We strongly oppose these unilateral actions, which will only serve to exacerbate tensions between Israelis and Palestinians and undermine efforts to achieve a negotiated two-state solution. We continue to support a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace in the Middle East, which must be achieved through direct negotiations between the parties. Norwegian Foreign Minister also condemned Israel's plans, saying the Israeli settlement policy on occupied land is contrary to international law and must be stopped. The Israeli settlement plans have also drawn condemnation from the Arab world. However, Israel's controversial right-wing minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said he wanted to see more Jewish settlements.
I say to Americans and Europeans, it's so worrying. This is our mission. This is our doctrine. Nine settlements are nice, but it's not enough. We want much more.
The comments fly in the face of international calls for a de-escalation of tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians after months of violence in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The international community views the settlements, hundreds of which have been built across the West Bank since Tel Aviv's occupation of the territory in 1967, as illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions due to their construction on the occupied territories. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Hossein al-Sheikh, a senior Palestinian official, welcomed the joint statement by Western powers condemning Tel Aviv's plan to build more illegal settlements, but said action needed to be taken. In a statement on Twitter, he said, "We demand that words be turned to deeds." Hardliners who oppose Palestinian statehood comprise a large part of Israel's new cabinet, which has put settlement construction at the top of its priorities. Extremist Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich said about 10,000 new homes are to be approved. Smotrich said he and his allies were committed to removing completely the restrictions on building in the occupied West Bank. Today, between 600,000 and 750,000 Israelis live in these seizable settlements, equivalent to roughly 11% of the total Jewish-Israeli population. The Palestinians seek those territories for a future independent state. Since then, the Tel Aviv regime has openly funded and built settlements for Israeli Jews to live there, offering incentives and subsidized housing. Their statements by the Western powers will likely have little effect on the Israeli hardliners. The regime has never been subjected to real sanctions or accountability. The Israelis have never suffered any pressure, so they keep doing what they're doing. 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank since the United Nations started keeping records in 2005. Over 140 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank last year. But already this year, we are only halfway through the second month of 2023, and Israel has already killed around 50 Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel has also regularly bombed Gaza, and now, with a right-wing cabinet in place, the situation is only expected to get worse. Israel's far-right cabinet has approved the legislation for 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank. All settlements are illegal according to international law, but who pays attention to international law in this occupied land?
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the United States, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown has had harsh criticism for corporate lobbyists and Norfolk Southern. The Atlanta-based operator of the train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, 2 weeks ago while carrying toxic chemicals. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, on Sunday, 19th of February, said residents in East Palestine, Ohio, are right to be skeptical after a disastrous train derailment leaked toxic chemicals in the air, land, and water near their homes. Should the residents accept the assurances from the government, or are they right to be skeptical about these assurances? Anchor Pamela Brown asked the senator on CNN's State of the Union program. Well, they're right to be skeptical. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA administration, when I was there, both the state and federal EPA administrators said that. But when you return to your home, we think the water is safe. But when you return to your home, you should be tested again for your water and your soil and your air, the senator said. A 150-car train derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, earlier this month, sparking fires at the site of the pileup and causing chemicals to leak from one of several cars noted to be carrying hazardous materials, including the cancer-causing chemical vinyl chloride. Nearby residents were evacuated due to fears of possible explosion as officials conducted a controlled release to try and alleviate the danger. And though evacuation orders have since been lifted, toxic substances have leaked into nearby air and water, sparking environmental and health concerns. Would you drink the water in East Palestine? And do you think the officials there who are saying it's safe, they should drink the water too, to show the residents they would drink it? Pamela Brown asked the senator on Sunday. Senator Sherrod Brown replied, "Well, I think they are. I talked to the mayor. The mayor said definitely, emphatically, people can drink the water." This is really the same old story. Corporations do stock buybacks. They do big dividend checks. They lay off workers. Thousands of workers have been laid off from Norfolk Southern. Then they don't invest in safety rules and safety regulations, and this kind of thing happens, the senator added. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown had harsh criticism on Sunday, 19th of February, for corporate lobbyists and Norfolk Southern, the Atlanta-based operator of the train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, 2 weeks ago, while carrying toxic chemicals. Speaking on Sunday to CNN's State of the Union program, the Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown said the derailment, which released toxic chemicals, including the carcinogenic vinyl chloride, was an episode of the same old story, and that Norfolk Southern caused it. Corporations do stock buybacks, they do big dividend checks, they lay off workers, Senator Brown said. Thousands of workers have been laid off from Norfolk Southern. Then they don't invest in safety rules and safety regulation, and this kind of thing happens. That's why people in East Palestine are so upset. They know that corporate lobbyists have had far too much influence in our government, and they see this as the result. These things are happening because these railroads are simply not investing the way they should in car safety and in the rail lines themselves. Senator Sherrod Brown said Norfolk Southern and corporate lobbyists were wholly responsible for the accident, which has caused breathing difficulties, rashes, nausea, headaches and swollen eyes, as well as killing pets and wildlife in the area. There's no question they caused it with this derailment because they underinvested in their employees. They never look out for their workers, they never look out for their communities, they look out for stock buybacks and dividends. Something's wrong with corporate America, and something's wrong with Congress and administration listening too much to corporate lobbyists. And that's got to change now. On Tuesday, Norfolk Southern pledged to distribute more than $1.2 million to nearly 900 families and a number of businesses affected by the crash, spill and the burn. A company spokesman said the financial assistance included direct payments of $1,000. Earlier this year, the company announced a $10 billion in stock buybacks. Last year, it reported $3.2 billion in profits. Senator Sherrod Brown warned residents along the Ohio and Pennsylvania border to be cautious. According to Senator Brown, the company made promises to him and the community, but he said if they write a check to an East Palestine or Unity Township resident or people even a little further away, never sign away your legal rights. You can accept a check, but don't sign anything that would sign away your legal rights. That's what companies like this do. He added that he was going to make sure that Norfolk Southern lives up to everything it needs to do. Senator Brown said he had urged Joe Biden and the U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg to strengthen regulations surrounding worker safety, consumer protection, and the environment. That's my job, to push the administration to move in Congress on more pro-consumer, pro-worker, pro-environment, and pro-community safety laws to make sure that these things don't happen, he said. Republicans, meanwhile, have criticized Pete Buttigieg's handling of the accident, arguing that the federal government has been too slow to respond. In a tweet on Wednesday, 15th of February, Buttigieg said the administration was restricted by certain laws on rail regulation. We're constrained by law on some areas of rail regulation, like the braking rule withdrawn by the Trump administration in 2018 because of a law passed by Congress in 2015. But we are using the powers that we do have to keep people safe, he said. That was a reference to an Obama-era rule that Trump administration repealed, which required trains carrying highly flammable crude oil be equipped with special brakes to halt all cars at the same time. Speaking to reporters, the Texas Senator Ted Cruz, the ranking member on the Senate Commerce, Science and Transportation Committee, said, I understand that the secretary is politically ambitious and he'd like to move to government housing in Washington right up the street, a reference to the White House, for which Pete Buttigieg ran in 2020, but he does have a job to do. Buttigieg, Senator Ted Cruz said, should focus on addressing the enormous challenges we have on our railways, with multiple derailments where the secretary has been absent without leave. The Ohio Senator J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio of Florida wrote to Pete Buttigieg demanding information from the U.S. Department of Transportation regarding its oversight of the United States freight train system, and more generally, how it balances building a safe, resilient rail industry across our country in relation to building a hyper-efficient one with minimal direct human input.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
Hello,
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
There is another quotation from the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, in his decree to Malik Ashtar. He says, avoid showing the existence of obligation on your subjects for having done good to them or praising your own actions. First of all, you should not think that the people are obliged to thank you for what you have done. And secondly, you should not exaggerate about what you have done, or making promises and then breaking them. This means making promises and then failing to honour them. Imam Ali alayhi salam warns Malik Ashtar not to act like this. And this is a very important point. Of course, then sometimes you make a promise, but later on you see that there is no possibility to fulfil it. For example, there might be a natural problem. It is all right. You should explain this to the people, saying that although you made this promise, a certain problem arose which prevented you from fulfilling it, and ask for their forgiveness. This is another case of speaking to the people. This is another example of popularity, as explained before.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, generally speaking, you should be careful about the promises that you make. You should impose a deadline for your promises. You should estimate the time that it will take to carry out a task and set a deadline for it, and then you must follow it meticulously. I have said many times among executive officials that we have no shortage of rules and regulations. We have an abundance of laws, projects, and rules and regulations. What we lack is serious follow-up. This is another point. It is very important for the administration to have solidarity, power, and mastery. The solidarity of the administration means that executive officials should not say contradictory things. If one official says something and another says the opposite thing, the people's minds and public opinion will change unfavorably. There should be solidarity both in words and action. The affairs of a sector might be interrelated with many other sectors. Your agricultural sector is naturally connected with a few other sectors. There should be cooperation so that the task in hand will be accomplished properly.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran, the most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajr International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including these Hungarian musicians. 7 concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Barbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What has made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajr Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran. The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, 3 notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The 3 anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it, Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh.